Right.
Let's begin. You want to take a source sheet. You want to take a source sheet and pass around. So, we've moved a long way in Bereshit. Started with Adam, and we have gone all the way through Cain, Hevel, Noah, Abraham. Spent 2 weeks on Abraham, spent 2 weeks on Yitzchak, and now we arrive at what may be considered the heart of Sefer Bereshit. We consider the heart of it in terms of the centrality of the chapters it takes up. The story of the two brothers, Yaakov and Esav. So I want to actually, let's begin by doing something very basic, something that we should always do whenever we're studying Tanakh, which is just to get a sense of structure, a sense of the overall picture. The stories of Yaakov... The stories of Yaakov and Esav really spread over... Actually, that's all of them. Really spread over three different parashiyot, which is Toldot, Vayetzer, and Vayishlach. So, started last week, when we focused on Yitzhak, continues this week, and carries on the following week. So what I'm going to speak about tonight, is not really focused on Vayetze per se, but is on the whole spread. So we've really got at least 10, 11 chapters from the very first time that we meet these two brothers, twins, Yaakov and Esav. We meet them in Perek Kafei, chapter 25 of Bereshit. So if you're just looking at the bullet points in front of you, here's the spread. So we really go from when they're first born, chapter 25 of Bereshit. It really finishes, you could say, in chapter 36, maybe more simply in chapter 33. It starts, of course, with the story of them in the womb, Esav coming out, Yaakov holding onto his heel, the early story of the sale of the birthright, the more significant story, but the one that seemingly built up to at the end of last week's parasha, the deception, the mirumah by Yaakov taking Esav's blessing, on account of which Esav decides to kill Yaakov when he has the ability. Yaakov flees for his life. That was Parashat Toldot. These middle chapters, 28 to 31, are Parashat Vayetze. What makes Parashat Vayetze one unit? What is it from beginning to end? Yaakov is abroad, right? Yaakov is not just out of the family home, he's outside of Eretz Yisrael, he's to the north, Padan Aram, with his uncle Lavan. We're looking for Lainus this Shabbat, I believe, if anybody wants to lane it. And if you do want to lane it, you'll notice something fascinating, that Parashat Vayetze is written as a single block. Right, there are no paragraph breaks in it whatsoever. And fascinatingly, it's all of Yaakov's time in Galut, all of Yaakov's time outside of Eretz Yisrael. There are angels at the beginning, right? And there are angels right at the end, and right at the end of the parasha, Yaakov calls the place Machanaim, which doesn't just mean encampment, but it means two camps. So Rashi links back and says the angels at the beginning of the parasha, the angels at the end of the parasha. They are the angels, like a changing of the guard. The angels of Eretz Yisrael went up the ladder when Yaakov left Eretz Yisrael, and the angels of Chutz La'aretz of the diaspora came down. And now, many, many years later, there's a changing of the guards again as Yaakov comes back into Eretz Yisrael. So Parashat Vayetze is Yaakov's time abroad. How long is it, by the way? How long does he spend outside? 20 years. Right? There are 20 years between Yaakov fleeing his brother's wrath at the end of last week's parasha, and being reunited with his brother at the beginning of next week's parasha. The preparations, you remember, maybe the most memorable, one of the most memorable of all of the scenes is Yaakov's fight, Yaakov's combat struggle with the angel, or the man, the mysterious man, at nighttime. And then finally, the meeting with Esav. So this story goes over three parashiyot. This story goes
over nearly 10 chapters. The story goes over 20 years. And how do we read it? What spin do we put on it? What's the overarching narrative? So I really actually want to share something really quite personal about this. Many of you will have heard the phrase Shivim Panim LaTorah. Right? There are 70 faces of the Torah. Now, the way in which that's normally explained is that, you know, Judaism is not one homogeneous idea. It contains so many different facets, so many different aspects, which is definitely a true interpretation. But a slightly different twist on the phrase Shivim Panim LaTorah is that the very same topic can have completely different explanations of it, all of which are considered to be Torah. That could be the case in a Talmudic or a Halachic discussion taking place, but it's also the case when we come to learn Tanakh. So about 9 years ago, I read a piece on Yaakov and Esav, not on one element of it, but really on the whole, on this whole selection, on this whole long spread, this long history, which blew me away. A piece which made me say, wow, that is fantastic. It combines everything, puts it into a single narrative. And I loved it, and it's the piece I'm going to share with you tonight. About 5 years after that, I read another piece. I read a few more pieces, and they combined with one another. And they gave a completely different interpretation to it. I don't just mean which way do you interpret a verse, or which way do you look at a certain idea. Rather, I mean a completely different lens with which to view the whole Yaakov-Esav story and linking up all of its critical elements. And I just had this very sort of strange feeling, maybe this was the first time I'd ever had it in sort of such a sharp way, that these two really irreconcilable ways of looking at the story of Yaakov and Esav both seem to me completely true. Over time, I've actually come to much prefer one over the other, but maybe that's a change in me rather than a change in the Perush. This week, I'm going to share with you the first one. Next week, I'm going to share with you the second one. And I want you to think of it, and you'll all have your own ones over time, maybe you already do. I want you to think that this is really the beauty of the study of Tanakh. My favorite, I told this to Ben last week, my favorite pasuk in all of Tanakh is a pasuk in Tehillim. One is the word of God, but two things I have heard. The nature of being human is that when we try to listen to the divine, we try to listen to God's message, we can't understand it in one clear way. We hear it in two ways. Now, that's the way in which I used to tell the pasuk to everybody for years. And then I actually went back and looked at the pasuk and I realized it's got a continuation. Achat diber Elokim, shtayim zu shamati. One is the word of God, but two things I have heard. Ki oz le Elohim. That is the greatness of God. It's not just that we've got some human frailty, which means we can't understand God completely, but the fact that we understand God in multiple ways, that is the greatness of God. So I want to just apply it to these stories of Yaakov and Esav. Today is part one. This is really all a piece by a teacher of mine, a man named Rav Yoel Ben Nun, who is not significant because he's my teacher. He's a very significant character in his own right. People heard of a book called Like Dreamers? Yeah, so Like Dreamers came out a couple of years ago, sort of made Rav Yoel Ben Nun well known to an English-speaking public. He's a major figure in religious Zionist circles, a major Tanakh teacher, but also really a major thinker within religious Zionism. As well as being a very significant educator, a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Rav Kook's son, also a student of Rav Amital. He was the paratrooper in 1967 and played a very significant role in discussions about the idea of force and the idea of power and the Jewish return to power and what that does. So we'll come to these ideas tonight. Let's just get to the text now. Enough of the introduction. Let's turn to really the beginning of last week's parasha, the original. We're going to ask two questions, two basic questions, which we're going to attempt to answer. We're going to answer them one way this week, we're going to answer them in another way next week. The first question, sorry, if you're flicking, we are Bereshit chapter 25, the beginning of Parashat Torah, page 126. The first question we're going to ask is why does Yitzchak love Esav? We're all familiar with the Midrashim, with the rabbinic commentaries, that Esav is a man of blood, a bloodthirsty person, somebody who is not an impressive religious character. Why does Yitzchak choose Esav? That's number one. Question number two is, if he has chosen Esav, then why does he not recant, why does he not retract the bracha that he thought he gave to Esav, but which he found out was actually, by deception, given to Yaakov? Why doesn't he just go back on it? Two questions. Why does Yitzchak love Esav? Question number one. Question number two. If he loves Esav, then why does he not remove the bracha that he erroneously, by mistake, gave to Yaakov?
That's the first time we get that expression, charei. You tremble, the great tremble, that's where the charei is.
Wait for
first
that.
First time that we hear that word.
We're going to come to that. Definitely going to come to that. So, people on page 126, Pasuk Kaf Zayin. V'yigdalu ha'na'avim. And the youths grew up. But he Esav ish yodei tzayad, and Esav was a man who knew how to hunt. Ish sadeh, a man of the field. V'Yaakov ish tam, and Yaakov was, however you translate the word tam, a pure man, a simple man. Yoshev ohalim, who dwelt in tents, one inside, one outside. V'yehav Yitzchak et Esav. Yitzchak loved Esav, ki tzayad b'fiv, because the meat, the game, the hunt was in his mouth. The Rifka hevet et Yaakov. The Rifka loved Yaakov. Why does Yitzchak love Esav? He fed him. What did he feed him? Sorry?
The things he would hunt.
The things he would hunt. Okay. Josh has said completely correctly what is there in the Pesukim. We've got to do a bit more than that, right? What does that mean? What does that give us? Why is the idea of the hunt, the idea of the meat, the idea of being ish sadeh a reason to love him? Ben?
Perhaps he thought that Judaism was going to be passed on through this fierce, active form of teaching. And we see that Yaakov is a very simple man. But Esav, with the game in his mouth, represents a more inspired Judaism, perhaps?
Interesting. So, I'm going to come back to that idea. Before we come to that idea, which is really one that will become the centre of our discussion, I just want to share a pretty disturbing idea that Chaval, be ashamed not to share it with you because it's there. What is it that Yitzchak is going to say to Esav two chapters from here before he blesses him? Go out and hunt for me. Prepare me some meat that you know that I like, so that I can bless you before I die. The meat always plays a role for Yitzchak, right? This isn't the only time that it comes up. What did we speak about 2 weeks ago? What is the story, the biographical fact of Yitzchak's early life, which you can't ignore, Brittany?
Yeah, I was going to say it relates to
the Arkada. Where's the meat in the Arkada? Well, he's not. What is? The ram. Tachat beno. That Abraham sacrifices tachat in place of his son. This is quite disturbing, this idea. But what is it to say? What does the smell of the meat represent for Yitzchak? The relief. It's not me. It's not me on the Mizbeah, it's not me on the altar, it's a ram. So Yitzchak throughout his life is always sort of like revisiting or need to revisit that moment when it's not him there on the Mizbeah. I don't like that idea because it's just too dark for me, but I love that idea. So that's the one I'm going to find. So Ben suggested an interesting idea. I want to pursue it. Ish Sayyad, a man who knows how to hunt. Sayyad, sad, hunting. Where's that come up? 4 now, in Bereshit.
Nimrod.
Cain and Hevel. The phrase comes up, Sad?
Edibrate, yeah.
Okay. So, I loved the putting up of the hand, Donnie. That appeals to my British politeness. But what can you do? We've got Noah here, and...
Uncouth
Los Angeles, no? But what can you do? Noah's got the smart idea. Chapter 10, everybody, of Bereshit. Who is it that we meet in chapter 10? To beginning, we are introduced to a man called Nimrod. Pasuk Chet, verse 8. V'chush yalad et Nimrod. Chush gave birth to Nimrod. Hu hachel lichyot gibor ba'aretz. He was the first, so we're on page 46. Very near the top. Nimrod was the first gibor ba'aretz, the first mighty man in the land. According to the Abar Benel, Nimrod is the first person who could be considered to establish an empire. Person who could control territory. Not just a person who could survive, but a person who could actually conquer. Hu haya gibor tsayad, b'nei Hashem. A mighty hunter before God. Al ken ye'amer, thus as it said, k'nimrod, just like Nimrod, gibor tsayad b'nei Hashem. Can't ignore the parallel. Right? Not just that Esav knew how to hunt, and rather than having to order their meat from the local butcher, they could just send Esav out to the field. That's not what the pasuk means. Clearly, the parallel between Esav and Nimrod is to say that Esav exhibits exactly the same qualities as Nimrod. Who was Nimrod? What made Nimrod special? The fact that he knew how to fight. He knew how to, in the phrase attached to Esav, Chayal Harbo, live by his sword. Ish Sadeh, a man of the field. That's the elements that Esav represents. Things that we actually see throughout Esav's career. Esav, described as a man of the field, who lives by his sword, a person who's got 400 fighting men when Yaakov comes back to meet him at the beginning of next week's parasha. A person who many kings are going to come from well before they ever come from Israel. We're told in Bereshit, Perek Lamed Vav, chapter 36 of Bereshit. That's what Esav represents. What's Yaakov? Ish Tam, a pure man, Tidman. Yoshev Ohalim, who dwells in tent. What do we know about Yitzhak? Yitzhak hasn't had the easiest time being the son of Abraham, and you know, it's not just, you know, being the son of Abraham is not just some spiritual inheritance. It's actually a day-to-day difficulty, a struggle to stay on one's land, to put up with those who want to dispossess you from the land, right? The only chapter, which we looked at last week, that is devoted solely to Yitzchak is Perek Kafvav, chapter 26 of Bereshit, where the whole story, you'll recall, is Yitzchak's struggle to stay on his land. The Plishtim wanting to drive him off it, refilling in the wells, etc. We spoke about it at great length. And now Yitzhak has two sons. Which one is he going to choose? Is he going to choose the one who may well be of the higher moral character, may well be of a more spiritually refined personality, but is a weak person? Not somebody who could really be expected to hold the fort, be able to hold the territory. Or does he choose the one who doesn't seem to be such a refined character, doesn't seem to be maybe such a moral person, but is one who he can be sure our territory is safe, our possessions are safe, our people are safe, we will not become extinct? We'll take questions in just one moment, but what a terrible dilemma. What a clash, what a confrontation between two completely different ideas. One who can continue a spiritual idea, perhaps, but is going to be a weak person. One who is going to be able to maintain it. And perhaps let's fast forward, right? Which one, if they're considered the other, which one is going to be the defining character of the Jewish people, of B'nai Abraham and B'nai Yitzchak. Are the Jewish people going to be a moral people, an ethical people, a spiritual people, but an Am Galuti, an exiled people, a people always pushed off their land, always moved from one country to another, facing one persecution after another? Or are they going to be a people who can look after themselves, who can live by their sword, who can put their enemies to flight, but one who has nothing particularly of religious and spiritual and ethical contribution about them, who takes the strength side of Abraham, but not the ethical religious side of Abraham? Donnie, do you want to go?
I was just
going to
say, I don't know if that connects, but I saw parallel also with the story of Cain and Hevel, how they both bring up offerings, but Hevel has like meat in it, and he actually like killed an animal for it, and God accepts it, and not Cain, which is just like produce. And
yeah, fair mod. Very, very good. Remember we said this right in our first class, right, that you can look, if you're trying to look at one theme of Bereshit from beginning to end, this, by the way, is Rabbi Sachs's new book, extremely relevant for the hour, called Not in God's Name, Confronting Religious Violence, which is basically a perush on Bereshit. Bereshit seen as five sibling rivalries. Cain and Hevel, Yitzchak and Ishmael, Yaakov and Esav, Rachel and Leah, Yosef and his brothers, right? Spot on, Donnie, to sort of see in the original brothers of Bereshit a lot of the tensions that are going to be worked out. Ben?
Why did it ever have to be done with each other? It seems like a pretty glaring fault in the way that Yosef was looking at the coming generations of the Jewish people, that it had to be divided brothers. They shared a womb. Why couldn't they share a nation?
Like, why wasn't it their choice? Why are you pointing at, like, you can point that at Abraham.
Right, but that's different. I mean, you could say that he knew that his descendants were going to come predominantly from Sarah, and Ishmael.
I mean, if
was
you read the Pesuk even order, it sounds like you're coming from Ishmael.
So then I'll ask the same question for Abraham.
Okay. Do you want to ask a separate question, Rachel, or do you want to address Ben's question?
No,
okay, so I'll give two answers then, two answers which contradict one another. The first answer is that I was wrong to say Bereshit is the story of siblings throughout these generations. It's more than that, it's the story of siblings and the selection of one and the rejection of another. Lama? Kacha. That's the way, isn't it? And it's something which needs to be looked at afresh in every time. And are they all the same one? And if you want to look at Bereshit as a whole and have a positive and comforting message at the end, what a difference between Cain and Hevel on the one hand and Ephraim and Manasseh on the other, right? The brothers at the beginning of Bereshit and the brothers at the end of Bereshit. However, to answer your... So, basic answer, that's it's not Yitzchak, it's the book of Bereshit. It's Hashem, and you might even view Bereshit as a microcosm for the Tanakh's idea of a whole, of a chosen people.
So then why was Yahweh able to break away from that?
However, I would suggest, this might have been what Jake was saying, that actually Yitzchak never intended that. Yitzchak actually, I think, read sensitively, and this isn't going to be our topic for today, maybe next time, doesn't intend to select one brother as opposed to another brother. He intends to keep both of them and to give them different jobs. Esav will clearly be the strength, the power, the one who decides the difficult decisions to do with physical existence. How do I know this? Well, the bracha that he thinks he gives to Esav is very parallel to the bracha at the end of Bereshit that Yaakov will give to Yehuda. Yishtachavu lecha, little mim, nations shall bow down to you, Yitzchak tells Esav. Yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha, your brother, the sons of your father shall bow down to you, Yaakov says to Yehuda. He's not selecting Yehuda and rejecting the others, he says you're the one who's going to be in charge, someone needs to be in charge. The bracha that he gives to Yaakov will be the Kohen, the Navi. He will have a separate spiritual task. Who is really the one that forces it? Rivka. Our topic for today is not Rivka, but Rivka is Shvera Sugya, they might say in certain circles. She's a difficult one.
She has the
Nebuah,
though.
She has the Nebuah. The Nebuah which is given to her, which says, Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir. The younger will serve, the older will serve the younger. And it's on the basis of that which she acts. I can't get into Rivka now and how to look at Rivka, but I think it's one of the ultimate questions, really, of all of Bereshit, certainly of this story, of how is Rivka judged. Speaking of which, Rivka, you had a question. Everybody know that Rachel's Hebrew name is Rivka? With that, I'll say come back
that's
next
a
week.
Yeah, it's a different
conversation. Everyone see just how wonderful these stories are, just by how, you know, the questions that Ben asks, the question that Rachel asks, that each one of them opens up a separate track, which is, you know, worthy of a whole shiur, a whole hour's discussion at the very least, in and of itself. Let's, if you don't mind, let's try and stick with this idea, and we'll come to a lot of these ideas next week. Yitzhak is faced with this choice, with this vision of two different sons. What's he going to do? So you know how the story develops. He says to Esav, let me give you the bracha. Rivka sees what's happening and dresses up. Yaakov says, it's going to be on me, I'll organize it. Let's turn to Bereshit Perek Kafzayin, chapter 27. Page 136. And Ben, would you mind getting me a glass of water? Thanks. Page 136. This moment of who the bracha is going to be given to, at least in Rivka's eyes, is going to be the decisive moment which son is going to be selected. What is the character of the future Jewish people going to be like? Rivka dresses Yaakov up in his brother's clothes. Yaakov goes to his... Thanks so much. Yaakov goes to his father, dressed as Esav. Let's read Pasuk Kaf Bet, verse 22. We're on page 136, Bereshit chapter 27. V'yigash Yaakov el Yitzchak Aviv. Yaakov approaches his father Yitzchak, v'yimushehu, and he touches him. By Yomel, and he says, Hakol kol Yaakov, v'hayadayim yidei Esav. The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esav. Which means, I'm confused. I don't know who's in front of me. I'm an old man, and my senses are giving me contradictory messages. Eventually, Yaakov seems to convince him that he is in fact Esav. He gives him the bracha, and as he leaves, Esav enters. I'm skipping verses. Makes also a dish for him. Let's skip down now to Pasuk Lamed Bet, verse 32, on the next page 138. Vayomer lo Yitzchak Aviv, Yitzchak, his father of Esav, says, Miata, who are you? Vayomer, and he says, Ani bincha b'chorcha. I am your son, your firstborn Esav, on the verse that Joe mentioned earlier. V'yichared Yitzchak charada gedola. Yitzchak trembled a great trembling. Ad me'od. V'yomer, and he said, Mi'efo hu hatzad hatzayed. Who was this person who hunted? V'yaveli, and brought it to me. V'ochal, and I ate from it. Mikol, b'terem tavo, before you came, and I gave him a blessing. Who on earth was this person? This great trembling, this great shock. What has just happened? But the verse isn't over. What's the end of the verse? Gam baruch yichyeh. He shall also be blessed.
What a strange ending. Is that what we would expect? Is that the conclusion? A person finds out they've been duped, that in the most, one of the most important moments of their life they've been deceived. Would they say that person is also to be blessed? Hard to imagine how that would be an emotional response. In halacha, and I'd probably suggest in almost any legal system, an oath or a pledge given under false pretenses is not an oath that stands, right? Very clear Gemara and Gittin about that. How does that happen in this case? Let's look at the Ramban, Nachmanides, bottom of page of the page. Beterem tavo v'avrachehu, he came before and I blessed him. Gam baruch yeh, he shall also be blessed. Says the Ramban, En derech hacharet charada gdola ad meod v'tzoek. It's not the way of a person who trembles greatly and he cries out, Mihu ha'asher imani, who is this person who deceived me? Levarechoto, to then bless him. She yashlim tzakato, to then complete his cry, leimor, by saying, Miyad, immediately, gam baruch yeh, he'll also be blessed. Haya ra'ui shiyakalalehu, he should have cursed him. Ve'od, and furthermore, ki ya Esav tzo'ek alav leimor, Esav cries out saying, V'lama v'tefarchehu ata avi, why do you bless him? Ve'ech ya'amin Esav ki b'mirma hayam itchila. The Ramban understands that this shouldn't have taken place. If you're coming in now, then do take a sheet and take a chumash and take a seat. Says the Ramban, two answers. V'hanachon ve'enai, and what's correct in my eyes. Shehu lashon hoveh, it's in the present tense, ye'amer, saying, Mi efo hu atzad asad ha'yashay yachol liramatani. Who is this person who could deceive me? She'avarchehu, that I shall bless him. V'gam shiyeh baruch al panim, al kol panim. Ki yadati ki baruchu. I don't quite understand the first answer, but this person who hunted shall also be blessed. It's the second answer, which I get more, which will develop more. Ota amor, perhaps his reason. V'gam yihyeh, gam baruch yihyeh, this idea of he shall all also be blessed. Al korchi, I'm forced to say so. I can't help myself from saying this. She'efshar li lahavir habracha mimenu. I can't now remove the blessing from him. Ki me'az shebarach oto, from the moment that I blessed him, yadua beruach hakodesh. I knew ruach hakodesh, divine inspiration. Shechala birchato alav, that the blessing was chalit, it fell on him.
It's a little bit weird because if he knew according to the Ruach HaKodesh, how he didn't realize that Yaakov is Yaakov and not himself. If he may have a Ruach HaKodesh, it's not like that.
Bechlet. Toby?
Well, I think it's like very halakhic, this answer.
So I agree with you as a reading of it. However, I'm going to keep Ruach HaKodesh in play in order to say a specific thing. Dorit? Meaning division of labor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. So, very, very good. Dorit, Baruch
Ivant. Well done for getting the direction that Rabbi Yoel ben Nun is going to go in. Okay? Rabbi Yoel ben Nun. Oh.
I didn't hear the sermon.
You took his class?
Yeah.
He's very difficult to listen to, isn't he, as a teacher? He's a marvellous person, very significant person. Very difficult to follow in his classes. Rabbi Yoel ben Nun has given the introduction that I've given, right? Who is Esav? He's comparable to Nimrod. He is tough, he is hard, he knows how to fight, he knows how to survive. Who is Yaakov? He is Ishtam Yoshebo Halim, pure, a book person, spiritual, more ethical. And now, Yitzhak has seen something, Baruch HaKodesh, some vision. And what is that vision? The words which I purposefully read earlier, Hakol, Kol Yaakov, V'hayadayim Yidei Esav. Right, the whole idea of this hour-long shiur, of this very significant idea, is summed up in the next 30 seconds. Hakol Kol Yaakov V'hayadayim Yidei Esav. The first time that we read it, the first time what it seems to mean is, Yitzhak's confused. He doesn't know what's what. Is it his son Yaakov? That's what the voice sounds like. Or is it his son Esav? That's what he feels. Baruch HaKodesh, the vision that he then has is that there is a new figure in front of him. There is a third figure. Somebody he doesn't know. Somebody he is completely confused about. Somebody who combines Kol Yaakov, not just the verbal voice of Yaakov, but the idea of a voice. The beauty, the ethics, the morality, the spirituality of Yaakov. V'hayadayim yidei Esav, but the hands, the physicality, the strength of Esav. This isn't Yaakov and this isn't Esav. This is a third character who combines, who synthesizes the two conflicting elements in his children. Who is this person? This person is not there right now. This person is an illusion at this stage. Because Yaakov is only being able to do this by trickery, by deceit, elements which are not characteristics which Yitzhak wants to be a part of his future children. But it's a bit of some possible future synthesis of something that can be attained in which the voice of Yaakov and the hands of Esav are brought together. Who is this person? This person isn't going to come into existence just yet. This person does not exist right now, at this moment. But whoever this person becomes, whoever becomes this person, he shall be blessed. He shall be the child of Yitzhak, the one who somehow manages to combine the two. When does this take place? When does this synthesis attain? Answer: Parashat Vayetze. 20 years Yaakov spends the Bet Laban and the house of Laban.
If it's true that Yitzhak had this realization that there's this character here, which I'm assuming he realizes either Yaakov or Esau, because
presumably
it's somebody who's managed to combine both quality traits and therefore this is the person who I want to bless because this is exactly what I'm looking for. What's with the Harada? He'd already
realized it. No, I think following the Rambam, he realizes it at that.
How did he not know at the time? Because isn't the whole point of Hakol Kol Yaakov Hayadayim Be'Esav is him being like, this is something different. This is something strange. It's either Esav who's managed to incorporate Yaakov's voice or Yaakov who's managed to incorporate Esav. And
do you understand Pinchas's question?
It's like the combination of his
dreams. It's the chronology. So. Let me answer by way of a different point in Sefer Bereshit. Right at the end of Sefer Bereshit, the brothers say, all of this has come upon us because we heard our brothers' cries in the pit and we did nothing. That's why we're being punished. What's the famous question about that pasuk? What's weird about that pasuk? We're never told that they hear the voice of Yosef crying in the pit. Right? When Yosef was 17, they sold him into slavery. Now, and we didn't hear that they heard him crying. Now, 20 years later, they say, we heard him crying, we didn't do anything. So you could ask a similar question. What's happening? So Nechama Leibovitz gives a brilliant answer, and I think it's the correct answer. At the time, they heard his cries, but only now did they hear them. Right? In the past, they were background. They were able to ignore them. Now, this time, they actually sink in and they realize the drama. So if I can apply that same model to you. The first time that Yitzhak says, HaKol HaKol Yaakov HaYadayim Yidei Esav, it's confusion. Who's there in front of him? A few moments later, that confusion brings itself actually into a vision. HaKol HaKol Yaakov HaYadayim Yidei Esav, who is this person? This is a vision of some future combination. Where does this take place? The Bet Lavan and the house of Lavan, Parashat Vayetze. 20 years. Working for Lavan, 20 very difficult years. We're not going to go through all of Parashat Vayetze, we're just going to focus on one little bit. Perek Lamed Aleph, chapter 31, all in the same Chumash, page 166. Watch these pesukim, and watch how these pesukim are exactly the synthesis that we have been talking about. Of a sense of justice and ethics on the one hand, with a toughness, with an ability to survive on the other. Lavan accuses him of running away, of stealing from him, of being unfair, etc. Now Yaakov, after all these years of putting up with Lavan, turns around furiously. Pasuk Lamed Vav, verse 36, on page 166. V'yichal liYaakov v'yarev v'Lavan. Yaakov became very angry. Quarreled with Lavan, Vayan Yaakov, and Yaakov answered, Vayomer Lavan, and he said to Lavan, Ma pishi, what is my crime? Ma chatati, what have I sinned? Ki dalakta acharai, that you pursue after me. Ki mishashtet kol keilai ma matzat mi kol keilitech, what have you found in there that you want to argue with me? The next verse, Lamed Chet 38, Ze esrim shana, these 20 years, Anochi imach, I've been with you, Rachalecha v'izecha lo shikelo, I haven't cheated you out of your goat or your ewes. Ve'etzonecha lo achalti, I haven't eaten things that I shouldn't have. Trefa lo heveti alecha, I never bought you a damaged animal. Next verse. Haiti bayom achalani chorev v'kerach balayla. In the daytime I was burned by the sun. In the nighttime it was the ice, the frost which attacked me, but tidosh natime enai, I was never able to sleep a wink. Zeli esrim shana beveitecha avadeticha, these 20 years I've been in your house. Arba esre shana b'shtei banotecha, 14 years for your two daughters. V'shesh shanim b'tzonecha, right? All of these years, I've been outside. I've fought outside. The sun scorching by day, the freezing cold at night, protecting your flocks, and not once have I conned you, not once have I deceived you. The next verse, Lulei Elohei Avi, Elohei Avraham, the Pachad Yitzchak, without the God of my fathers, of Abraham, of Yitzchak, I would have been nothing. People see this? In chapter 27, when Yaakov deceived his father, it was exactly that, it was deception. The vision that Yitzchak saw didn't actually exist. Nobody then was combined. Kol Yaakov v'Yidei Esav. The ethics, the morality of Jacob with the voice, with the hands, the toughness of Esav. Then it was a vision, an illusion. Now it's become reality. Yaakov has been able to learn how to combine them. Into next week's parasha, Yaakov sends messengers to Esav. Just the second verse of the parasha. Kotom run la adoni leisav. That's what you say to my master Esav. Koyamav decha. Im lavan garti. With lavan did I live. If you know one Rashi on Sefer Bereishit, you know this Rashi. Im lavan garti. V'taryag mitzvot shamarti. And 613 commandments did I keep. Right? Garti, taryag, same letters. People understand the beauty of that now in this vision. It's not just, oh, I've been keeping 613 mitzvot. In that environment, living with Lavan, really having to learn how to fight by the sword, having to be outside, having to protect a flock, protect the territory. Nevertheless, Tariag Mitzvot Shamarati. Of course, what seems to be... Yeah, Toby. Question, because I hear the question, I really disagree with you, and I think I disagree with you for an interesting reason, right? Who are the leaders of the Jewish people? Answer, shepherds, right? Everyone knows this. Anybody who becomes leader is a shepherd. So this midrash, I've never actually seen this midrash. I don't actually know if it exists. It might be made up by a ganenet. If it does exist, please show it to me. I'm not dismissing it, but what's the famous midrash about Moshe? Moshe out there in the wilderness, right? And he sees this one little sheep who's gone missing, and he goes all the way to look after this one little lamb, and finally he finds this one little lamb, and he holds it, and he cuddles it, and he looks after it, and then he sees the burning bush, and that's how Moshe became Moshe. Right? You all told this story when you were younger? Right, I did. So what does a shepherd mean according to that midrash, or nursery story? A shepherd means someone who gives a lamb a cuddle, somebody who looks after people, somebody who cares, who's compassionate, who's, you know, he shepherds his flock, they say, about nice rabbis and nice vicars, right? So that's one reading of what shepherd means. But I don't think that is pshat in Tanakh of what a shepherd is, right? Go to Sefer Shmuel, the young David presents himself to Shaul, says, I can fight Goliath, I can beat this Plishti champion. What's my qualifications? I've been a shepherd for my father. And you know what I had to do? I had to be a shepherd for my father. I beat off lions, I beat off wolves, I killed a lion with it. Being a shepherd is a tough job. You live with nature. You've got to fight to protect what's there. Every wild animal wants to eat sheep, right? What is the qualification of being a shepherd? I really think toughness. Maybe care as well. You know, we've got limited time. I don't want to go too long, but Corinne and I, in our past life, in our future life, in Eretz Yisrael, one of our favourite things to do was to try and go on to Yule every couple of weeks. And we lived not far from area around Bet Shemesh, beautiful hills. And one afternoon, beautiful rolling plains, we come across an Arab shepherd and his flock of goats and sheep, and the most enormous guard dog you have ever seen. A huge jowl, like gigantic, must have been, you know, 200 pounds. And this guard dog was just, like, it looked terrifying, and it was amazing how gentle he was for the sheep. And we asked the shepherd, like, how they bring up the dog to be like that. A puppy, they put the dog with the sheep, so he gets to know them, gets to play with them, and then whenever he starts snapping at them, they hit the dog. And whenever the dog looks after the sheep in some way, they give the dog a reward. And this other couple came along, also on to Yule, probably from Tel Aviv, because they had some snappy little dog with them about that big. And being a Tel Avivi dog, this dog like yaps up to the big dog, like picks the fight, runs at it, barking, and the big dog just turns around and looks at it, and literally just looked like a cartoon. The small dog like skids to a halt, you know, like in cartoons where like someone's trying to reverse as they're still going forward, right? He sort of like sees how big it is and sees that this dog could like swallow him in one bite and just goes flying back to his owners. And Corinne and I are basically on the floor laughing. Maybe it's a combination of these things. So Toby, I hear the question, but I'm going to say that I actually really think that Yaakov and David in the Pshat and the simple reading in Tanakh, what do they say? Being a shepherd is a qualification for real toughness. Where does the story seem to reach its apotheosis? Obviously, that nighttime combat, that nighttime struggle with the mysterious man. How fascinating, right? That Yaakov of all people, is the one who gets his sort of ultimate religious sanction in fight, in combat, fighting with this man, worthy of discussion another time, of the idea of combat as a religious metaphor. And what is the blessing that he gets at the end? So we're on page 176 now, Perek Lamed Bet, chapter 32. Pasuk Kaftet, sorry, just 1 second, Joe, let me finish this point. Verse 29 says, Yaakov, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. And he asks him his name, Mashmecha, what is your name? Vayomer Yaakov. Vayomer, and he says, Lo Yaakov Ye'amer Od Shemecha, your name shall no longer be Yaakov. Ki im Yisrael, it shall be Israel. Why? Ki sarita im Elohim. Ve'im anashim v'atuchal, because you struggled with God and with man, and you overcame. That is Israel. And look at Rashi. You should have it there. Lo Ya'akov. Right, if you've got, we're all following the same one. The end of the second line. Lo Ya'akov. Lo Ye'amer. It shall no longer be said, Od. Shehabrachot ba'ulacha be'ekvah. The blessings came to you through working around, through going by the heel, the remayam, through cheating and deception. Ki im brashara v'galui panim. They came to you through honesty, through sincerity. V'sofcha, shahadosh baruch hu nigleilecha be'etel. And God will reveal himself to you in Bethel as this person. You are no longer somebody who gets what he gets through deception, which was the only way that when you were purely Kol Yaakov you were able to survive. You get what you get through sincerity, through acting straightly, at the same time as being able to fight for what you need. And this accompanies Yaakov for the rest of his life. This hard-earned combination of being able to fight for himself on the one hand, at the same time as being able to keep his moral fibre on the other. Just one more place to flick to. A long, long way away from here. Bereshit Perek Memtet, chapter 49 of Bereshit. Right at the end of his life, Yaakov giving the blessings to his sons. But they're not all blessings, are they? Who are the two sons that don't really seem to get a blessing at all? Shimon and Levi. Why not? What is it that Shimon and Levi have done? What's the act which has condemned them? In the aftermath of kidnapping, the rape of Dina, they slaughter the whole city of Shechem. We're on page 276. Perek Nimtet, chapter 49, Pasuk K, verse 5. Shimon v'Levi, klei hamas machorotehem. Shimon and Levi, you are brothers. Weapons of violence are your trade. V'sodam al tavonachshi. Let their secret not come to my soul, but kahalam al-techa, they shall not be part of my counsel. Look at Rashi again. Rashi about a third of the way down the first column. The word, the one that starts, klei hamas, basically halfway down. Klei hamas, weapons of violence, umanut zu shel ritzicha, hamas hu biyadchem. These weapons are the trade of murder, violence is in their hands. Mibirkat Esav, Izu. The blessing of Esav, this is. Why is it that Yaakov is so furious at his sons, Shimon and Levi? Not just because they haven't lived up to what he's wanted, but precisely they haven't got the lesson that he has spent his life trying to learn. That the ability to be tough, on the one hand, doesn't automatically have to mean that one lives a life of violence, one lives a life of murder. It's so difficult, but it is possible, it must be possible, to be able to combine that with a life of morality, a life of justice, a life of religiosity. So, we're going a bit longer than I wanted to, so I'm going to cut short the last bit, but this has to be said even in brief. Famous saying that's applied to Sefer Bereshit, Ma'aseh Avot Siman L'Banim, the actions of the forefathers are a sign for their children, signed for their generations. Something that a lot of political philosophers like to speak about, most famously German philosopher Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, many Americans pronounce it Nietzsche, is this division between two sorts of moralities. Right? Nietzsche speaks about slave morality and master morality. What is the morality? The Ubermensch. What is the morality of the masters? To be strong, to rise above others, to dominate others. The morality of the slaves is to be kind, to turn the other cheek, because that's their only defense mechanism. Nietzsche's insight and Nietzsche's challenge is that it's possible to be moral and it's possible to be just when you're in a position of weakness, when you don't have the responsibilities of power. When you're in a position of power, then it's a very different sort of morality, which is the easiest one and the most natural one, to just use strength as the end in itself. Rabbi Yoel ben Nun finishes his essay, and I mentioned before that Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, not just a Torah scholar and a teacher, but also a soldier and somebody who's thought very, very hard about what Judaism in the age of the state of Israel must mean. He finishes his essay as follows. Me'ever ha'nahal ha'yabok ha'histori. On the other side of the river Yabok, the river that Yaakov crosses, the historical one, after a long, long galut in the middle of the night, 2,000 years of being a people only of Kol Yaakov, we find ourselves now returning to combat and in a position where we actually have to also use Yidei Esav, the hands of Esav. And our challenge and our great aim and aspiration of this generation is to be able to fuse exactly that, to be able to achieve that synthesis of Kol Yaakov with Yidei Esav. So this return to Jewish power, which the 20th century brings with it, can't lead us to becoming like any other nation or nations which have idolized the use of power, the use of force. It has to be balanced and intention alongside with this idea of Kol Yaakov. This isn't an easy confrontation. They're in tension with one another, but it's the model that Yaakov spends his life learning, and it's the challenge for our generation.